Up next, the magicians. Marcus Chown back with us on Coast to Coast. We're going to go live to the United Kingdom and talk a little bit about magic and science on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Marcus Chown back with us. His latest work, The Magicians, he's an award-winning writer and broadcaster, former radio astronomer at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He's a cosmology consultant of new science, author of several books, including, of course, The Ascent of Gravity and The Magicians. Marcus, welcome back. How are you?
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm fine. How are you?
Everything's good. Are you on lockdown out there in the United Kingdom, too?
They're kind of just releasing it, but I don't believe the government has really got it under control, and they're releasing it when we're still getting, you know, I would say 1,000 people dying a day, you know. So I think the government in Britain has made some huge mistakes.
And the story keeps changing.
Very worried.
The story keeps changing, too. I'm not sure anybody has a handle on what's going on.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of defenders of our government say, well, no country's got it correct, but we have the highest death toll in Europe, you know, so we've got a problem which is severe, like in the United States. So they've somehow engineered the worst possible outcome.
Well, you've got a new book out called The Magicians. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, basically it's about the central magic of science, you know, that you can write down a mathematical formula on a piece of paper, on a blackboard, on a whiteboard, and it predicts the existence of something, but when you go and look for it, you actually find that it exists in the real world, you know, like a black hole or a neutrino or a Higgs particle. So really it's this central magic that there is this, the real universe has a mathematical twin that you can write down on a piece of paper, and nobody knows why this works. So if I give you an example, Antarctica was found by people that went out in ships and discovered it. They actually physically discovered it. But Neptune was discovered by a man sitting at a desk with a quill pen in Paris in the mid-19th century. So he was the first person to demonstrate this, that you could actually discover things in the real world on a piece of paper. So really, that's what my book is about.
Who are the magicians, Marcus?
Well, I picked about 10 of them. The one that's probably most important to you and me talking now is James Clerk Maxwell, who was a Scottish physicist, probably the most important physicist between the time of Newton and Einstein. And he basically was the person who discovered that light, which we see with our eyes, is in fact a wave of electricity and magnetism, what we call a ripple in the electromagnetic field that spreads through space. And when he did this, he realized that the visible light we see with our eyes, you know, the colors of the rainbow, from, you know, red all the way through to violet, are only a small fraction of the colors that are possible. You know, there are millions of invisible colors. We call them radio waves now, X-rays, ultraviolet, all this kind of stuff. So who's the person to realize that you could get electromagnetic waves that oscillated more rapidly than the visible light we see, or more sluggishly? And, of course, that's radio waves. They were detected about 18 years later, so this was about the late 19th century, and of course they've created the ultra-connected world that we live in, and you're all listening to this program because, you know, a mathematical formula predicted the existence of the radio waves, which are sending our voices out to everybody in America at this moment.
Would you have called Einstein a magician as well, Marcus?
Absolutely, you know, absolutely. I'm tongue-in-cheek about the word magic, but I'm
saying
that the core of physics is this piece of magic that nobody understands. A guy called Eugene Wigner, who was an Austrian physicist in 1960, he wrote a paper, he talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the physical sciences. So he understood that there was this mathematical twin. We don't know why the universe is mathematical. One of the physicists that I refer to, also tongue-in-cheek, said God must be a mathematician. You know, you can discover the laws of nature on a piece of paper, and then you go out and you find that these things, you know, that you predict exist. But no one quite knows why it works. So I call it the central magic. Interestingly, this on a slight tangent, in 1665, during an isolation because of a plague, just like today, Isaac Newton changed the face of science.
That's right.
With his law of gravity, he was the first person to realize that white light from the sun was all the colors of the rainbow, you know, intertwined. And he did that during a lockdown, just like today.
And when you think of magicians, we think of sleight of hand. That's not the case with what you're doing.
Not sleight of hand, but we don't know why it works. That's the key, thing. And those who can work with magic, they're a kind of, I give a lot of examples, but most people, most physicists are just like you and me, okay? So they think about the real world in terms of everyday objects. So they're trying, if they're trying to understand magnetism, they're trying to think in terms of things they can see, you know, compare it to things around us. But one physicist didn't think that way at all. His name was Paul Dirac. He was a British physicist. In fact, oddly enough, he was in the same class at his school when he was five as Cary Grant.
So oh,
Cary
really?
Grant, who became a huge film star in the US, actually went to school in Bristol and was in the same class as Dirac. Well, Dirac was a very logical person. He was kind of a Mr. Spock of physics. But he actually plucked what we call a Dirac equation out of empty, you know, out of thin air. He basically liked pretty mathematics, and he sat with a piece of paper at St. John's College in Cambridge in 1927, and he wrote down an equation we call the Dirac equation, which turns out to describe the electron and predicts things like that the universe has something we call antimatter. But he's an example of someone who actually plucked something out of thin air. In fact, his equation is on a flagstone on the floor of Westminster Abbey, the cathedral in the centre of London. I did think it was the only mathematical formula on the floor of Westminster Abbey, but then someone told me Stephen Hawking's got one as well.
Marcus, when you devoted a chapter to the prediction and discovery of neutrinos, yeah. what are they exactly? And you did spend a lot of time on them.
I did, because it's a fascinating story. That neutrinos are ghostly subatomic particles, right? Now, wherever you are, if you're driving a truck or whatever, if you hold your thumb up at the moment, there are 100 billion, that's 100,000 million neutrinos flooding through your thumbnail every second.
My God.
And they were generated by the nuclear reactions in the center of the sun that produce sunlight. So as a byproduct, they produce these kind of ghostly particles called neutrinos, and there are 100,000 million going through every square centimeter of your body every second. 8.5 minutes ago, they were in the heart of the sun. And the neutrinos turn out to be the second most common particles in the universe. The most common are photons, but those are particles of light. But the second most common are neutrinos. And pretty much everything else, you know, we look around at matter and atoms, is a minor contaminant, a minor constituent of the universe. So neutrinos are amazingly common. Now, they were predicted, interestingly, in 1930 by a man called Wolfgang Pauli, who was a bit of an infant prodigy. In fact, he stood up after a lecture by Einstein. Now, Pauli was only 20, and he stood up and he turned to the audience and he said, "What Professor Einstein has just talked about isn't completely stupid."
Huh.
It was a pretty arrogant thing.
It sure was. Einstein must have turned his head.
He's having a terrible time. His mother had committed suicide. His wife of 6 months had run off with a man down the road, was sitting on the other side of the road, and he distracted himself by physics, and he had to solve a particular problem. Now, if you imagine a gun, when you fire a bullet, the bullet always leaves the gun muzzle at the same speed because there's the same amount of charge, same amount of explosive charge, right? Imagine if when you fired a gun, sometimes the bullet went fast, and sometimes it just dribbled out and fell 1 foot from your gun muzzle.
Hmm.
That was exactly the problem with atoms. They were spitting out electrons, like tiny little bullets, and sometimes they came out really fast, and sometimes they came out really slow. So Pauli realized that maybe there was a second projectile. So if you had a second projectile coming out of a gun muzzle, if it took all of the energy, then the bullet would have very little left and would just dribble out. If it took hardly any energy, then the bullet would come out at high speed. So he postulated that the electron bullet had another invisible particle coming out with it, which he called the neutrino. But no one had ever detected a neutrino, so he knew it would be incredibly difficult. In fact, he bet a case of champagne that no one would ever detect one. And it took until 1956 when it was detected in America.
Can you see it with a electron microscope?
You can't see a neutrino. So one of the problems with neutrinos is they are unbelievably antisocial. So they pour through your body, and pretty much none of them are ever stopped. You know, you could have millions of miles of lead, and they would go straight through it. So you think, well, how do you detect them? Well, what you do is you have a lot of material, and then occasionally one neutrino will be detected. So, for instance, in Japan, there's a big detector. It's kind of like a 10-story high, you know, baked bean can filled with water, and very occasionally a neutrino from the sun is stopped by an atom, and it produces a flash of light, which is then detected by light detectors. So it's the overwhelming majority of neutrinos just flood right through you. So you have to have a lot of matter to stop one. I can tell you about how they were detected in America, because it's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, how did they find these things?
There were two guys called Frederick Reiners and Eugene Cowan, and they've been exploding hydrogen bombs all across the Pacific during the 1950s. And they got kind of sick of just blowing up islands. And, you know, obviously we don't do anything as ridiculous as that anymore.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do something. And they kind of met on a plane. They were going to a conference from Los Alamos in New Mexico to Washington. Their plane had engine trouble, and they were in Kansas City. And they got talking, and they realized they got on. And they asked each other, what was the most difficult experiment in the world? And they both said, detecting the neutrino. And so they set about this task. And at one point, they were going to put their detector 50 meters from ground zero of an atomic bomb explosion. And they even dug a 150-foot vertical shaft at the Nevada test site, bomb test site. And they were, at the moment the bomb went off, they were going to drop their experiment, so it was going to fall down this shaft, and therefore would not be in touch with the ground, and so it wouldn't be shattered by the shock waves coming through the ground. It would fall 150 feet. At the bottom, they were going to have mattresses and feathers, and in about 2 days after the atomic bomb had gone off, some poor person was going to have to, you know, walk across the radiation-scarred landscape and retrieve the experiment. But at the last minute, someone at Los Alamos said, well, maybe why don't you use a nuclear reactor? Because neutrinos are not only produced by nuclear explosions, but they're produced by nuclear reactors. And in the end, it was they detected a nuclear reactor in South Carolina. And they won, well, one of them, Frederick Reiners won the Nobel Prize. Unfortunately, Eugene Cowan died before he could get his Nobel Prize. So they actually had detected what the predictor, Wolfgang Pauli, had said was totally impossible, and better champagne, a case of champagne that nobody would ever detect.
I want to get into the Big Bang after our break, but you also talk about black holes, and you've said that Einstein didn't even believe they existed.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
It is.
The people that push ahead science, And they're revolutionaries, and they go beyond what everybody else thinks. They themselves get mired in the end, you know. And he had his theory of gravity, which he came up with. He presented in four lectures in November 1915 at the height of the First World War. He was in Berlin. His theory of gravity, which we now call general relativity. And it predicted the existence of black holes. It also predicted the existence of the Big Bang. Neither of those things did Einstein ever believe in. So you can go so far as a revolutionary, and then you get stuck. And Einstein was one of those people. So he never believed in black holes. That's right.
And what are black holes, in your opinion, Marcus?
Well, black holes are simply regions of space where gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape. So they're literally black.
It like pulls it in. It pulls it in, I guess.
That's right. Well, in the picture of Einstein, you see, Einstein realized that gravity is not a force. It's what we call the curvature of space-time. So if you imagine, the Earth goes around the sun, not because there's a force, like an invisible tether between the Earth and the sun, but because the sun creates a kind of valley, a depression in space-time. We can't see it because it's a four-dimensional thing. It creates this valley, and the Earth goes round the sun rather like a roulette ball or round a roulette wheel, something like that. But if you have a mass that's very, very concentrated, the valley becomes steeper and steeper, and eventually it becomes like a bottomless well. But, you know, and light literally cannot climb out of this well because it is so steep, and that's a black hole. And when we look around in the universe, we see two types. I mean, one forms is a star-sized black hole, so when a star shrinks at the end of its life, and then every galaxy, for some reason we do not understand, has a supermassive black hole at its heart.
Isn't there always a concern, Marcus, that if an object such as a planet gets too close to the black hole, it's going to get sucked in?
That's exactly what happens, and this is how these objects are powered. So the supermassive black holes at the heart of galaxies, and we've got one, we've got a little tiddler in our galaxy. It's only 4 million times the mass of the sun, but some galaxies have ones which are 50,000 million times as massive as the sun. They are powered, as you just said, by planets and stars which get too close and are shredded. What actually happens is that the material of these stars and planets is smeared out. It's rather like water running down a plug hole. So there's this, what we call an accretion disk of in-swirling matter around the black hole. And friction within this disk heats this disk of in-swirling material to millions of degrees. And that's how these objects give out their power. This is, makes them the most powerful objects in the universe. But you're absolutely right. It's the shredding of matter falling in that powers them.
Isn't there a huge black hole in the Milky Way galaxy, Marcus?
That's right. It's not big on the scale of the ones from our galaxies. And me and you are having this conversation because we live in a galaxy with a small central black hole.
Right.
If we lived in a galaxy with a big central black hole, thousands of times bigger, we wouldn't be not having this conversation because from these black holes, they project these incredible jets of material which fly out at the speed of light in opposite from their poles. And this material sweeps away the gas and dust which forms stars. So they actually have an effect on their surrounding galaxies. If we were in such a galaxy, we would not have evolved. There probably would not have been a sun. There would not have been a planet like the Earth. So we're only having this conversation because we're living in a galaxy with a relatively small black hole. But there is a project called the Event Horizon Telescope you may have heard about.
Yeah.
As set up to actually create an image of a black hole. And last year in April, they presented the first image, which was of a very big one in a nearby galaxy called M87. A black hole about 5 billion times as massive as our sun. Currently, they're still reducing the data. They're still fiddling around with the image of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So they should be actually publicizing that probably this year, and we will see for the first time what the black hole at the center of our galaxy looks like.
Let's talk about the Big Bang when we come back in a moment, Marcus, and then we'll take phone calls with you next hour. Those of you who are really into science, you're going to love the phone call moment next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Marcus Chown with us, as we will be talking about all things space. What is it about the universe that excites you, Marcus?
I suppose the most exciting thing for me at the moment is that we can only see 2.5% of it. Okay, so we've now discovered, incredibly, after 350 years of science, that the visible stuff, the stars and galaxies, the planets, you and me, accounts for 5% of the universe, 5% of the mass of the universe. And only half of that 5%, 2.5%, have we actually seen with our telescopes. The rest of it, we think it might be invisible gas between the galaxies. So only 5%. And it turns out that there is about 25% is what we call dark matter. Okay, we know it's out there because we can see it pulling on the visible stuff. So we see all the visible stars and galaxies moving in ways we would not expect. So we say there's stuff that's got gravity, but we literally can't see it. And about 70% is what we call dark energy, and that was only discovered in 1998. Can you believe it? The major mass component of the universe we didn't know about until 1998, which is like 22 years ago. And we've got really very little idea what dark energy and dark matter are. So really, we're in this weird position. Imagine if Darwin was going to come up with his theory of evolution, and he only knew about frogs and snakes, but he didn't know about insects, and he didn't know about fish, or most of the things in the animal kingdom. I mean, what kind of theory would he have concocted?
Exactly.
So we've got a theory of cosmology, and it's based on the 2.5% or the 5% that we can see. So I think that's pretty amazing that most of the universe is invisible. So if anyone out there, or if any kids who want to go into science and they think it's all sewn up and there's nothing more to do, we don't actually know what most of the universe is made of. So I find that very, very exciting.
And when you say it's invisible, but it's there, does that mean in theory if you launched a rocket toward it, could you crash into it?
You couldn't crash into it because one of its characteristic is that it doesn't give out light, okay? So what we mean is it doesn't interact with light, and light is a product of what we call the electromagnetic force. So it doesn't interact with the electromagnetic force. So the electromagnetic force is responsible for kind of the repulsion. So the reason that if you try, I don't know, if you put your hand on the cab of your vehicle or on a desk,
you can feel it.
Your fingers don't go through that desk is because there's a repulsion, an electric repulsion between the electrons and the atoms in your fingers and the electrons in the atoms in the table. Okay, now dark matter doesn't feel that. It doesn't experience that. So literally, you would fly straight through the dark matter as if it wasn't there. You know, so you wouldn't crash into it at all. You know. So, I mean, so the dark matter, as far as we know, the dark matter is in the, you know, it's in the studio where you're actually, you know, talking to me from. It's in the room where I'm talking to you from. It's everywhere, but it doesn't interact with normal matter. So it doesn't bump into normal matter in any way, and that's why we can't detect it.
That's strange. How do we know it's there?
Simply because if you say... I'll go back to my book, The Magicians, because the first magician was a guy called Urban Le Verrier, and he deduced that there had to be another planet because there was a planet Uranus, or Uranus, however you like to pronounce it, and it wasn't orbiting the sun in the right way. It was weird, its orbit. So he postulated that there had to exist another planet further out whose gravity was pulling on Neptune and perturbing its orbit, and he predicted the existence of Neptune. Well, dark matter is simply the Neptune of today. You know, we see things moving. So, for instance, we see stars orbiting around the cores of their galaxies, and they're moving too fast. By rights, they should be flying off into intergalactic space. So what we infer is that there's more matter whose extra gravity is gripping onto them. So it's rather like, it is just like Neptune, you know, because things are moving. We see things moving in a way that we cannot explain from the visible stars and gravity, and their gravity, stars and galaxies and their gravity. We infer that this stuff is around. So there's about six times as much dark matter as there is ordinary matter.
That's amazing.
If you can figure out what it is, there's a Nobel Prize waiting for you in Stockholm.
You got that right. Could there be life out there on the dark matter?
That is a fantastic question. Because the default position of physicists is they think the dark matter might be made of some subatomic particle we haven't found. Okay, so they think it's amorphous. You know, it's just all made of just one thing. But the thing that we know about ordinary matter is it's not made of one thing. It's made of 92 different elements, all the way from hydrogen to, you know, uranium naturally occurring, These pieces come together to make molecules, to make life, to make planets. So one thing we know about ordinary matter is that it clumps into complex organization. So who knows? The dark matter could similarly be made of lots of different particles which clump together, as you just said, to make maybe dark stars, dark planets, dark life. You know, could that be the answer to why we have, after searching for 50 years, searching for signals from extraterrestrials, we've never found them? Could it be that all the activity is in the dark matter? You know,
That's right.
There's all this activity going on all around us and we can't see it. Who knows?
I mean, but in theory, Could planets collide? Could a planet that we see collide with a planet that is in the dark matter stage?
It certainly could, that's a good question. That's a good question. One of the problems with at the moment, one of our problems is that why do planets form? You know, why do stars form? You know, why does material shrink to form, you know, from gas clouds to form stars and planets?
Right.
Okay.
Throughout the entire universe. I mean, it's uniform.
I'm just going to make a comparison. I'll tell you why dark matter may not clump. The reason it can do that is because, well, first of all, if you have a big cloud of gas in space, it's warm. And the warmth of the gas pushes outwards against gravity, right? So the thing can't collapse because gravity's trying to squeeze it, but the hot gas inside is pushing outwards. Okay, so the only way it's going to collapse is if it loses that internal heat. Now, normal matter, what actually happens is it radiates. It radiates what we call microwaves, which is a kind of light that we can't see. And that light or heat escapes from the cloud. So because normal matter radiates, the interior of gas clouds is robbed of heat. So gravity in there can then crush it. Now, dark matter does not interact with light. It does not produce what we call electromagnetic radiation. So it has no way of removing its internal heat. So as far as we can tell, it can't shrink or collapse in the same way as ordinary matter. So when we infer its existence, so for instance, if you think about our Milky Way, I don't know if anyone's got a picture of our galaxy, but it's kind of like a whirlpool of stars, you know, a flat whirlpool of stars. We believe that the dark matter is actually a spherical cloud in which the Milky Way is embedded, because although the ordinary matter could shrink down to form this flat spiral, the dark matter couldn't, because it couldn't get rid of its heat. And if it can't get rid of its heat, gravity can't crush it. Now, so that kind of contradicts the thing that I just told you about how we could have dark stars and dark planets. But of course, it's quite possible that there is another type of light, dark light. You know, there is another interaction other than the electromagnetic interaction, maybe dark light, and that dark matter could collapse because of that reason. But we think that that's why. Now, if it were possible to have a dark matter planet and it did collide with the Earth, I think we would feel it.
You would think so.
Difficult question.
You would think so. Let's talk about the Big Bang for a moment, Marcus.
Yeah.
My gosh, how could something create itself from nothing? I still don't understand it. Nobody knows.
No.
will we ever get the answer?
Hard to tell. I mean, what we can do is, which is incredible, I mean, you know, remember that we are an ape that arose on an African plain 3 million years ago with a brain, a 3-pound brain, you know, made mostly of jelly and water. And yet with our telescopes, we've seen to the edge of the observable universe. We can see what the universe is made of, about 2 trillion galaxies, 2 million million galaxies like our own. And we also have an idea that because all the galaxies are flying apart from each other, they must have been closer in the past. And if we run that kind of movie of the universe's expansion backwards, you know, like a movie in reverse, we come to this time 13.82 billion years ago, when everything was compressed into a smaller region, the Big Bang. So we know that's correct. We know that's correct. But as for, you know, you always come back to this fundamental question: how did something come from nothing?
I know it's just thinking of it.
Yeah, the answer is that we don't really know that. But I would tell you that in the modern picture, which is, we bolted on some other ideas onto the Big Bang. Okay, so the Big Bang model now has a few other things bolted on. It has dark matter bolted on, it has dark energy bolted on, and another thing it has bolted on is what we call inflation. And in this picture, the Big Bang is not a one-off. So it's not the only Big Bang. So these Big Bangs are going off all across this huge universe, rather like firecrackers, you know, randomly. So we are just one. You know, we're just in the vicinity of one of these big bangs.
Religious people, Marcus, will say God did it and leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, the problem with that, the problem with adding inflation is you just push back the problem. Because you say, well, yes, there was something before the Big Bang because there was what we call this inflationary vacuum. And when it decayed randomly, it was expanding and it decayed, those decays were Big Bang universes. But it turns out that inflation itself had to have a beginning. So although you've said, well, okay, there was something before the Big Bang, you know, there was what we call inflation and there are other Big Bangs, you still get to the point that inflation had to begin as well. Well, I don't know. I mean, the problem with it, again, that isn't really, you can believe that God created it if you like, but obviously that's not the preserve of science because one of the characteristics of science is that you put very little in and you get a lot out. So, for instance, you have a law of gravity, which you can write on the back of a stamp, and that explains tons of stuff. It explains how planets are formed and stars, how they orbit stars, how stars orbit in galaxies. Tons of stuff comes out from a tiny, tiny little thing. So you get a lot out, you put very little in. With the God explanation, you have to put a lot in to get a lot out. In fact, God has to be more complicated than your universe. So it's kind of the obverse of science. So you can believe that, but I mean, it isn't really the preserve of science, you know, because science doesn't work that way. Will we get a scientific explanation? I hope we will get a scientific explanation because basically, I mean, let's go back to Newton. Newton was an incredibly religious man. And the reason he did science was because he believed he was getting an insight into the mind of God. That's what drove him, because he wanted to know how God had put the universe together. So he didn't see any conflict whatsoever. You know, he thought, I want to figure out how God did this. So, you know, that's one way of thinking about it.
It is perplexing, but it's exciting at the same time, Marcus, isn't it?
Incredibly exciting, because when you think about it, previous generations would have killed for the kind of information that we know. That's what we know about the universe. Imagine previous generations have had to speculate and say, oh, you know, the universe is on the back of a turtle or something like that. Or they've had ridiculous theories which are, you know, they could invent, basically. But we can't invent it because we now know what has actually happened. We're one of the first generations in history to know that the universe that we see around us was born 13.82 billion years ago. Okay, that's only three times further back than the age of the Earth.
That's right.
The universe is not very old at all. It's quite young. And we know that, so the picture is that 13.82 billion years, for some reason that we don't know, a blob of blistering hot matter appeared, began expanding, and out of the cooling debris, they congealed the galaxies. 2 trillion of them. We live in one, the Milky Way. And this is an incredible picture.
It's mind-boggling.
No generation before has had this picture of where the universe came from. But, of course, the ultimate questions we don't have the answers to. You know, what was the Big Bang? What drove the Big Bang? We don't have those answers.
And then you add in the complexity of life and everything else with it. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely amazing. You know, and of course, when you see that it's arisen on the Earth and according to the fossil record, life, there's evidence of life about 3.8 billion years old, nearly 4 billion years old. So almost the moment the Earth was cool enough for life to form, it formed. And that gives us hope that life will have risen elsewhere
Absolutely. It's teeming. It's everywhere, I think.
Yeah. The slight problem we have is that it did take about 3 billion years to go from the simple, you know, single cell stage bacteria to the complex stage of multicellular organisms. And that kind of implies that it's a difficult step to make.
Mm-hmm.
So what we might find is that the universe is absolutely teeming with life, but that most of it is quite simple.
That's true.
A bit like Donald Trump. No, I shouldn't say that.
There's your shot. Well, see, we balanced the show. We had the pro-Trump person on earlier, so that kind of balances that out again.
Well, Boris Johnson. We in Britain, we have Boris Johnson.
How's he feeling with his coronavirus?
Well, you know, I see pictures. He seems personally, I feel he should have stood down because my wife is a nurse, and if you go in intensive care, that is a really, you're very, very sick.
Oh, absolutely.
He came out of intensive care, and he was back at work within 3 weeks. Well, even I had pneumonia when I was a child, and I remember it was 6 weeks until I went back to school. You know, I was 11 years old. I had to do lots of physiotherapy, you know, because I had to blow tissue paper and things because my lungs were not working so well. I personally, I think he's gone back to work far too early.
Interesting. Marcus, we're going to take a break. We're at the top of the hour, but we're going to come back and take phone calls with those who love science.